the first thing that came to my mind is I was a mess, and physically and emotionally, and who I was a question that I don't think I was able to answer until I was in my 30s. And I certainly tried on a lot of hats and attempted to be what I thought other people wanted me to be. And at the time in my childhood, I wasn't able to draw a comparison between how some of my earlier life experiences had already shaped how I entered and desperately fought to maintain relationships. And more than that, how I was desperate to avoid disappointing others and being left, which at least in my life, personally and professionally, that is a string that it connects so many of us in recovery and those of us trying to help others navigate their recovery as well.
I never give up. I never give up. I never give up. Turn around.
Hi, guys. Welcome back to Neff Inspiration, my show on YouTube and as a podcast with me, your host, Stefan Neff. Today is another fantastic day for an interview because I've got Andrew Levander here. Andrew is a man who has made it his mission to befriend his own nervous system in order to improve his own regulation, improve his own state, improve his chances of experiencing joy, serenity, etc. All those beautiful sensations that we are yearning to feel, yet so many of us are on a hamster wheel and just racing around and very rarely achieving those moments of bliss. So I can't wait to talk to Andrew to figure out how the hell did he actually get to the place now where he is in this beautiful state. Andrew, welcome to my show.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
Absolutely. Andrew, it's not just one day when you're a teenager that you wake up and say, you know, mommy and daddy, I figured it out. I want to be a person who befriends his nervous system, who knows how to massage his parasympathetic nerve so that I'm in the best possible place. Yeah, that's what I'm going to do. And I make my money out of it. Yeah, no teenager says that ever. Who was Andrew the teenager? How did Andrew become the Andrew that he is now?
Oh, the first thing that came to my mind is I was a mess, and physically and emotionally, and who I was a question that I don't think I was able to answer until I was in my 30s. And I certainly tried on a lot of hats and attempted to be what I thought other people wanted me to be. And at the time in my childhood, I wasn't able to draw a comparison between how some of my earlier life experiences had already shaped how I entered and desperately fought to maintain relationships. And more than that, how I was desperate to avoid disappointing others and being left, which at least in my life, personally and professionally, that is a string that it connects so many of us in recovery and those of us trying to help others navigate their recovery as well. But I don't even know if I could spell the word brain or parasympathetic at that time. It only became important to me because I was so unhappy for so long.
Well, but typically the very first thing is not that you look up positive coping mechanisms. At that time, when we were younger, there was no internet. There was no nothing where you could quickly look up something. If you wanted to learn something, you had to go with a big bag to the local library and get yourself a book out. So that was not easy. And typically, no teenager will open a book by chance, will it, or by choice. No, you choose other things. What took the pain away? What were the real coping mechanisms when you were a teenager?
Oh, I had a long love affair with opiates, which specifically amphetamine codeine. I had migraines as a kid.
Interesting.
I was they were kind of handed out as Tic Tacs,
Where was that? In which area was that?
At home in Los Angeles.
Interesting, because the same codeine, dihydrocodeine, were used a lot in the UK in sort of the eastern part. There was just in the 80s, everyone just throwing them out like nothing. Intriguing. Okay.
They were being handed out by my mother, and I think with a sincere interest of helping me not feel I had debilitating migraines. And there was, in that moment, at least in hindsight, there was a cause and effect. I had a migraine. I took this pill. I felt better. But along the line somewhere, and I don't know when it is, I started to realize that I started to take them when I didn't have a migraine. And I preferred that over feeling everything. It worked.
Well, exactly. And we see that so often, isn't it? We see that so often because people who have been privileged enough not to experience addiction sometimes think, why the hell do you do that? Because the alternative, feeling the pain or feeling the disconnect, feeling the emptiness, is so much worse for part of our being that we run away, that we escape reality. And in your case, your mom, probably with very good intentions, tried to help you with a painkiller. She didn't realize that codeine is probably one of the worst painkillers that you can use for that, because it's a shit drug. It doesn't work well. 15% of population don't have the enzyme to break it down. It's very short acting. So therefore, even if it works, you're clock watching, thinking, oh, when can I take the next one? It's a perfect drug to set you up for addiction, ultimately. Equally, we know that the earlier we start, certainly with drinking, the data is there, the earlier we start with regular consumption of it, the more likely you developed addiction. So here you are. You were set up from the word go due to adverse childhood experiences. And then with a well-meaning mother, you were set up to fail, essentially. Far out. Bad start of a day. But having said that, I mean, how long were you on the opiates?
The last, and I switched to Vicodin for at my drug of choice. The last Vicodin I took was December 28th, 1991.
Wow.
So from 1974, 75,
wow,
to my migraines, with some periods of, I can't even call it sobriety, but my headaches got better for a while. But on and off since I was 6 years old.
Okay, that's really starting on the back foot. Having said that, migraines are very clearly I'm lacking the word, such a miserable disease that really hammers you. Just out of interest, nowadays that you have got your life in a much different control and you've learned so many different coping mechanisms, do you still suffer from migraines?
I don't.
Funny that is, isn't it?
I think the last migraine that I had, and I'm talking kind of head-crushing migraines, rocking and crying in the middle of a room with a blanket over my head kind of migraine. I haven't had one in probably 4 years.
Interesting. Yeah. Because that's again, and that is sort of the beautiful insight that you have shared there. Because when we start going on a root cause analysis and start teasing apart those things that contribute to chronic suffering, let's call it like that. This could be an autoimmune disorder, it could be the migraines, could be the suffering from endometriosis, from many other of the chronic diseases. There's not just one thing, but actually there is often a genetic disposition, and then epigenetics flowing over it, the trauma that we have experienced, sometimes the trauma that previous generations have experienced, but also the our behaviors then that will switch on and switch off certain genes and result in certain things. So
of all that, on top of the biology and the organicity of the addiction itself, because I started using benignly so young, I kind of look back and feel like I missed the socialization, emotional regulation, skill development part, which I don't know, is a double whammy, really.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And then would you agree that ultimately an addict, if you look at it when they started using, that really that's the typical time when much of their development, their emotional development, certainly stops?
Yeah, I mean, I think it's referred to at least here. You know, it's like arrested development.
Exactly. And it's weird because then you face a man in his 40s or 30s who has got the emotional abilities and emotional intellect of a six-year-old.
Yeah,
and that's so hard. And people don't realize that again, isn't it?
Yes, because there are a lot of expectations that come with aging. And it's like, aren't you old enough or at your age? And that just... added to the ever-growing script that I was already working from, the tapes of not good enough, I've done differently, if only. Yeah. It was tough.
We're often enough out of such adversity, there are also positive things coming out. In my case, I became actually very good at school. I chased the external validation from school or then later from university. I come from a very poor socioeconomic background. No one has ever gone to university before me. So therefore I got accolades and that made me feel good. Were there things like that with hindsight that there were positive aspects from your childhood? From the pressures that you were under?
Yeah, you know, I just found myself experiencing envy listening to you because I also had a really significant learning disability as a kid. I wasn't able to latch on to something to have a sense of competency somewhere in my life. I think a lot of that came later on in early adolescence. I can remember I was 12 and 13. I had my bar mitzvah and I was an overweight kid. And all the girls liked the kids that weren't overweight. And so I learned about kind of food restriction and exercising. And I would, to your point, that looking for that validation, it took a little bit, it was more work. And so what I did feel competent in as I began high school, 13, 14, 15, as I really unhealthily lost a bunch of weight, was hospitalized for a whole summer for an eating disorder. And then when I emerged, the problem that I had was, it wasn't that girls didn't like me, it's that I didn't know what to do with the attention that I now was receiving with the deficits pre-existing of kind of socialization and insecurity. So, I don't mean any of this from a poor me. What's coming to my mind right now, it was an incredibly difficult an exciting time of life.
Isn't it? Exactly.
My way, and when I couldn't find my way, I would go in the medicine cabinet and I would dump some pills into my hand and then that would take it away. And so early on, area of competency was I figured out how to stop the world and get off for a little while when things got too much. And then that's what 30 years later got me to want to know more about my brain and how that works and the vagus nerve system. And now I can just, I just kind of rub my neck here. And that soothes my nervous system.
Oh.
And I have to go spend an hour in my brain all by myself. What I know about our brain, yeah, it can be a bad neighborhood. And what we know about a bad neighborhood is we should not go alone. And yet most of my clients in the past 25 years and in myself, we always do that. We rely on ourselves and our faulty thinking to get us out of harm's way. And it just, it stopped working.
But hey, what about the American dream? You are a self-made man, a real man who, you know, you have feelings like you're hungry from now and then. That's it. Hey, we have been indoctrinated for, I don't know, decades with that bullshit. And whilst it is very, very true to say that we need strong men, but we need men who actually are also strong emotionally. And I think that is what we are lacking very miserably nowadays in society, which then leads to many, many other problems. But that's more philosophical now. Wow, man, what a start of a story.
I apologize for my being really emotional, and I didn't wear it with any courage or honor that I'm a highly sensitive person. And I think it's what's, I think it's one of my greatest assets now. Life's a little bit harder being sensitive to lots of things. I don't think I could have been as helpful both to myself and to other people as a clinician and a survivor if I didn't kind of accept and appreciate that part of myself. So when you were talking about this masculinity, I really see that the way that I am is a good definition of that as well.
Beautiful. Absolutely beautiful. I think that is so important today, because we have got such a confusion in our society, especially amongst younger men, with regards to, well, what are the attributes of a man? We are supposed to be absolutely everything. We are supposed to show every single bit of vulnerability, but then if we're really vulnerable, then the girls are turning away. And if girls, I mean anything from 8 till 80, who are saying, well, you're not a man. They don't say it consciously, but you know, suddenly you've got conflicts in a marriage where there is, where's that coming from? And suddenly a previously good relationship, which was relying on yin and yang, is now turning into confusion and maybe a toxic relationship and divorce down the line.
And maybe it's just kind of reframing, which I do for myself. What makes sense to me is I remember a long time ago hearing that not dependency, but neediness is not an attractive quality. Generally, and so if my neediness was out of needing to be accepted, I wasn't confidently I wasn't confident about it, and so I have caused so much harm to myself in how I learned to think about things and continue to, like I wrote down this morning when I woke up, who sets the bar? And why I think that's related here is because I have maintained the rules to the bar that I think was set for me. When I got older, I think I wanted to champion my own bar. And they say that we will rise to the lowest expectation. And I don't know who said it, but I can definitely see how I did that.
Yet, out of interest, I mean, here you are saying the lowest bar. I've always set the bar so high that I even if I was Superman on speed, I could never achieve those things that I set myself as tasks for the day. And therefore, I proved myself constantly that I'm a failure. See, you're a failure. You didn't even get half of your jobs done. When in reality, no sane being was ever able to do that. So I was setting myself up a failure for that with a high bar. You were saying low bar. Interesting that we both ended up still failing in our own minds. How bizarre is that?
And I see this all the time, that all of our stories are different. But the one thing that is really similar is the pain that we feel underneath it. We've never met each other before. And I just, right when I first met you, I'm like, I have this thought, for those who understand, an explanation isn't necessary. And for those who don't understand, an explanation isn't possible. I immediately got that, that you understood. And so those are the types of relationships that I crave now, as opposed to being in the conversion business and setting myself up for lots of disappointment by picking people that, like, my picker was broken before.
I love it, the conversion business. I love it. No, that's right. We can't just mold other people to our expectation, but what we can be is be very open in our willingness to explore. And only because you're open, like me, having you on my show, making myself vulnerable and being authentic, and suddenly we create this bond that we both have never met yet. We both are speaking so honest with each other, more honest than probably I could speak to 95-98% of the people that I normally know and that I normally converse with. How is that? It is, but that's beautiful. And that is, I think, the positive side of trauma. That is the post-traumatic growth that allows us to actually change our state of victimhood to initially a survivor and then a thriver. And I think that is where you are. You have accepted yourself, warts and all. But not just that, you have learned tricks. And tricks is a negative word. You've learned different coping mechanisms. You have developed different skill set that allows you to do things. I want to come back to the vagus nerve, because you actually did something very simple, the rubbing the neck. And I for a moment, I thought, why the hell did I never think of that?
You know, it's 2024. It's hard to think of something or research something that, you know, I haven't thought about before, until I kind of latched onto this idea. Right now, I love internal family systems therapy, and I love neuropsychology. And the vagus nerve is the longest nerve in our body. It originates at our brainstem, and it flows through our body, which made complete sense to me, because when I'm dysregulated or anxious, or wife comes home and I'm on the kitchen floor scrubbing it, literally managing my internal world that works for some reason, the scrubbing of the floor. I now don't have to, have to do that. I can just sit down like in a chair like I, and ideally I put an ice pack, works much quicker and better, right on either side of my neck.
Yeah. From a doctor's point of view, for those of you listening and watching, what you do is a carotid sinus massage, essentially. It's actually a technique that has been used in medicine to calm down very overactive hearts. So if your heart rhythm suddenly jumps into a very fast heart rhythm, then this is something that a lot of people learn how to do. Equally, put pressure on their eyeballs or cold water into their face. These are all triggers to overstimulate the parasympathetic, the vagus nerve, and calm, therefore, the heart rate down. Just a word of warning, when you're young, and I guess we too are young, I would call ourselves young, we are still okay to do that. At at one stage, especially if there's strong heart disease, etc., in your family, just be a bit careful there, because when we have got plaques sitting there, which is basically little pieces of trash that are sitting inside there, and you vigorously rub that, what can happen that this trash flies off and you get actually a stroke. So there is that problem. Equally, if you learn to press on your eyes, make sure that you actually have got an eye examination, that you don't have glaucoma or another eye disease where additional pressure might actually cause harm to you. So just a little word of caveat. The vagus nerve, there's absolutely what you're saying is so important. And in breath work, we do the deep breathing, which stretches the vagus nerve due to the diaphragm, but also the exhalation to breathing out. We actually make mild sounds, vibration sounds in the throat, which again stimulate the vagus nerve. So, 10,000 ways to skin a cat.
This is why I love it, because I don't need permission. There are no barriers to doing it other than myself. Either if I, or I, for some reason, maybe I'm in a frame of mind where I'm not ready to let myself off the hook for something, as an example. But I love that I don't need permission to take care of myself. And as lots of us know, we rarely get it. We rarely get permission from other people to do what's truly best for us. So I just cut off the middleman, and it doesn't require permission. Story, I think, and it has a different sense of importance to me.
That's beautiful. That's absolutely beautiful. I mean, it is. We have got the power to make small changes. And when we're in the midst of darkness, we often don't realize that. We think we're hopeless, we're helpless, we're failures, and there's all these kind of negative thoughts running through. Yet it's so bizarre, because we've got 60,000-80,000 thoughts a day, and here we are, I'm a failure. And that's the one you latch onto? It's just, what the which is happening here? And so you are taking a different approach. You're actually saying, no, bullshit. Yes, imposter, all normal. Yes, I'm a failure. Yeah, okay. But what you're doing is actually you're starting to change your state. And in your case, you're using the parasympathetic nervous system. And that is only one tiny skill that you have developed, but it's a very powerful thing to immediately change your state. But there are so many more things. I mean, yes, you can change your state, but if you don't do anything else, then you stand rubbing. You will be there rubbing the whole day. You might as well keep your hand there. But I mean, it's great. I mean, are there any other sort of maybe first aid? We should call them first aid mental health skills. I like that.
Some others, right? As you were forming the question, I started thinking that. You know, the biggest one for me that probably led me to being willing to do the research to learn more about myself, to care enough about myself, to find alternative ways to be in this world, was the first loving act in this journey of getting away from thinking that I'm a piece of shit. So the other one was I had to get honest, and we talk about it all the time, and it is hard to do. I was living in denial for a long time. I even have appreciation for denial. I think it kept me safe during that time.
Exactly.
And misunderstood, and that's okay now. But I did have to get honest with myself. That was the hardest thing I think I ever did.
Was the first time you spelled out, I'm an addict. Did you go for a 12-step system of sorts?
I did. Each morning. And this morning, actually, I heard from 40 men in my all men's meeting, the only thing I have to do is the next right thing. And that was so simple. And yet I want to complicate it.
Yeah, that's fine. What was the first time when you spelled it out, I'm an alcoholic or I'm an addict? How did that feel like? Can you remember?
Well, I remember feeling like I had run out of options, that I had just finished breaking into homes in the community and going into people's cabinets, and I wasn't able to deny it anymore. And So I was loved enough for an intervention to happen.
Beautiful.
And then I'm going to pick you up at 8 o'clock tomorrow morning. And we're going to go to a meeting.
Yeah.
And I've been going on and off for the last 39 years.
Beautiful. For me, there was actually a kaleidoscope of emotions attached to that first moment, but it was actually such a, with hindsight, such a release, such a relief, and such a, as if a dam was broken and suddenly emotions were able to come out that otherwise were hidden, because it's the hiding that we are so good in, and denial that we are so good in, when we try to escape our pain. Addiction is a disease of in the shadows. And often 95% of people have denial. That's part of being an addict. So there you go. Wow.
I wrote an article years ago called The Great Lie. And it's too long to go into here. But in essence, The Great Lie is something that I believed in from early on, and that I think a lot of us in any stage of recovery believe in. And that is, if anybody knows me, the real me, all the warts and all, they won't love me. And for me, at least, that is how I began to conceptualize and put all the pieces together. That's why there's minimization and denial and justification and isolation, and because we're in service of the great lie. And I don't, I wish I knew the day that I decided to make some addition, edits on that script I was working from. But I'm grateful that I did. And it turns out it's not true. It isn't true. I can be myself. Other people can be themselves, and cared about at the same time.
And it's fair enough to say that if you are yourself, you automatically jettison some people around you, because when you're an addict, you surround yourself often enough with those people who want to sustain your addiction. Because if you drink more than them, then it feels good for them. Or at least there's a justification. Hey, he's drinking as much. We're all drinking. We're all social drinkers. Yeah, exactly. And then suddenly when you actually turn around and say, hey, actually, there's a lot of pain sitting inside of me, and I want to talk about this pain. I don't want to just drown it in just another vat of vodka. Suddenly those people very quickly disappear. And there's nothing wrong with that. So whilst initially...
It is difficult to maintain a position of denial around people that aren't with you there.
That'd be good.
So, and you know, we learn in those moments, or at least I did, well, I guess I can't hang out with this person. So if no one in the group is being honest, that is a perfect environment for everybody to, everyone in that group is hurting.
That's true. That's very true. Wow. Oh, man. I mean, these were hard times for you, man. No two ways around it. But here you are nowadays, 25 years in the making of helping others. But it's good to talk about our origins, because that is what is forming us. If you were able to go back to your younger, to a younger version of yourself, which key message would you tell that younger person?
it's not your fault.
Nice. Maybe we two should, we both should actually create a time machine and send it back to our younger selves, isn't it? Oh, dear. My God.
The website was talking about and hanging out with who we hang out with, and is this thought that, and the treatment center that I run now, that is the result of 25 years of thinking about creating a place for people like me, who want to do the work and have difficult conversations. 72% of all of our clients who are male have an experience of childhood sexual abuse, and we still don't talk about it a lot. And that was the impetus for creating this drug and alcohol treatment center, was the idea of treating the whole person, is the in pain underneath their drug and alcohol use and bad behaviors. And I have some of the greatest conversations. Men who maybe have never talked about it before. And I'm able to. And I think part of it is I'm loaning them some of my, courage, or all the work that I've done. I loan that to them. To set the stage for, oh, by the way, this is okay to talk about here.
That figure is staggering. But if you actually look at international figures, the chance of a sexual abuse is huge. If you look at lifetime prevalence, so of it happening to you through a lifetime of you being on deserve, that's about 1 in 3 in women. 1 in 5, 1 in 7 with men?
The current statistic, it's a great organization out here called 1 in 6, male survivors.
Right.
And the statistic is 1 in 6 boys before the age of 18 wanted sexual experience or a trauma. I generally use the word sex because that's not what it is. And the statistic is 1 in 4. Girls. And we have to do better.
Oh, hell yes. And I think it's a very silent kind of thing. I want to say though one thing to everyone listening out there. This is not a pissing contest, okay? You don't have to suffer from flow-on effects only because you were not raped, because you were not fondled in a very malicious way. That is, your experiences are your experiences. Your pain is your pain. Okay, so let's be quite honest about that. You can have PTSD or complex PTSD with things that other people would just say, yeah, that's normal. That's okay. It is. These are your feelings. Okay. No one has got a right to sort of deny that you have these feelings. Other people might have the ability to let you reframe some experiences, and I think that is where people like Andrew come in. I mean, you're a great sounding board, because ultimately, when we say denial, it also means silence. People never spell it out, never write it down, what actually really occurred. You just have this nebulous kind of dreams, thoughts, and they're all things that are not written down or spelled out. The moment you put it in words, it becomes a very different beast. I love it that you do the journaling. Has that always been part of your skill set, your tool set?
No, because I was dyslexic, and I mean, somewhere along the way, I went to regular school, and then I went to a special school after.
Yeah.
I couldn't write. It's always been, because when I would take notes, the teacher would say house. I always started my writing with the last syllable.
Okay.
And then I couldn't keep up. So I learned to do that over again. Now I love writing.
Interesting. Okay. How did you change, or what did you change in order to fulfill you now?
I stopped the silent suffering.
Nice.
I figured out how to have thoughts and feelings and not do anything about it, which I think lots of us think is the, we have to get busy. And
I'm laughing here because it's just that is still one of the hardest things for me to actually accept that, yeah, today is a day that is not a great day, because yeah, you feel sad and you feel maybe down, and maybe, yeah, whatever thoughts there are, whatever emotions there are, feel them and accept them for what they are. And if they're really, really bullshit, then okay, maybe do something about it. Change your state. Do something. Take action. But equally, we need to actually start accepting who we are. And that means to actually feel the emotions before we run away, before we try to drown them, before we do something about them. Wow. Okay. There's so many questions. So we could talk for hours here. Andrew, you're an amazing man. You're an amazing being. That is, wow. But you're out there to help people. And tell us a bit about the work you're doing now. And tell us a bit where people can find you if they want to explore more of their own background, maybe their own not so great coping mechanisms at the moment.
Yeah. Well, we have a relatively new, about a year and a half old, treatment center. And people ask me a lot, like, well, what makes you different? And I'm having a hard time with that, because I know in my heart, and I've been thinking about this place for 25 years, and it's special. And I think one of the things that makes it special is not because we have cognitive behavioral therapy groups and we teach dialectical behavioral therapy skills, and that's not what it is. It's promoting the ability to have a conversation like you and I are in the treatment environment to highlight that nothing bad happens, that vulnerability doesn't equal, there's no equal sign required after, like, I'm afraid to be vulnerable. I picture this equal sign, because that equals something to stay away from. And we could put a period there. Like, being vulnerable is being myself. My intention is to live a life with integrity. Then there really isn't anything much for me to think about. Because I would be missing it if I didn't allow myself to just be. And so trying to teach other people here at the Encino Detox Center, we're a licensed 12-bed alcohol and drug detox and residential program. We're really great at co-occurring disorders. All of us have something going on underneath it. And so that is the person that I look forward to getting to know in the short time that they're here. And we're in a suburb of Los Angeles, in a town of Encino, which is a really beautiful little community. And you wouldn't know that we were here. We'd take up a corner. It's a gorgeous property. We have all the accoutrement, like all private rooms and flat screen TVs and all the stuff that those of us looking for an excuse why we can't go to treatment, I kind of built that into why we have some of these things. there's no jacuzzi. How can I go? Oh, no, we have a jacuzzi.
Oh, exactly. That was my first impression when I went into Capri 10 years ago, the Capri Hospital. And you walked in there, and there was this massive jacuzzi in the center of this living area with four big lions. And I thought, what I mean, it does looks like sort of like a like the scene for a porn movie out of the 70s or something like that. They probably nicked it from there. But it was perfect because actually it became in the evening, it became one of the places where people congregated and talked and shared emotions, shared breakthroughs, etc.
Maybe it's as simple as that, that's what makes us special, is that lots of little alcoves where we just talk.
Exactly.
And, you know, on our website, it says relationships are the antidote. And then there's a period. And then it's everything.
Well, I love it. Exactly. Well, because
find me at the Encino Detox Center.com.
Beautiful, guys. Look down there into the description of the YouTube video and of the podcast, because Andrew's details are down there. And why not consider this as one of the best investments in your life? Now, everything costs money. And certainly when I went into rehab, we couldn't afford it. But we took out a loan, and with hindsight, it was one of the best investments ever I've done in my life, because it allowed me so many breakthroughs. It started me off on a journey of ongoing breakthroughs. Rehab is only the start, but it's a very powerful start, because you are making headway so fast, your head is spinning. Typically, and then you lose a bit of that momentum once you leave rehab, but that doesn't mean to say that there is not ongoing support. Can I assume that there's also an outpatient treatment component with you? So after people are leaving the inpatient rehab, that their groups keep going?
Yes, not only do we have an alumni program, which is growing, which I think is one of the best parts of a treatment program, wherever it is, it's maintaining those relationships, is we start discharge planning from day one. One, because most of our clients are here with insurance. We do take cash pay, but most of it is insurance. And the stays are not usually longer than 30 days. And so we have to get busy planning the next steps. So who's gonna pick up? It's like a relay race. Who are we going to pass the baton to?
I liked it a lot.
There's a very small list of places that I trust, and we together.
Beautiful.
In the work that we're doing.
Oh, beautiful. Andrew, thank you so much for being a guest on my show. Thank you so much for the work that you are doing out there. Thank you so much for showing the authenticity and the being humble enough to share all those very private thoughts with me and just a few thousand other people here. But it's that being open about one's journey that makes you change. And I'm careful to say that, because every single time we tell our story, we are changing. Every single time we are growing, every single time there is a new revelation, and that makes it so powerful. So I think this is a gift that we are giving each other here by sharing our thoughts. For that, I'm actually very, very grateful to you that you allow me to bounce things back and forth here. But I think it is with us doing that, I think we both can become the candles or the torches or sometimes even the lighthouse in the darkness of others. And I think that's so important, that is, let's actually share those facts, and let's make it our key message to send out. It's not your fault. I love that. I love the message that you are sending to your younger self. And there is so much happening in other people's lives, but I hope you all out there are realizing that there is hope there, that there is help there. You just might not be able to see it at this moment, but if you're in the dark, maybe Andrew's setup is exactly what you need. So here you are, guys. Don't give up. That's all I want you to know. Andrew, you're an amazing man. I sent you all the energy and love for you to continue this journey and grow and allow more people to hear your story and to work together with you to become a new version of themselves, something that is maybe kinder to themselves, and in turn maybe we can make this world a better place.
Yeah, very much appreciate being asked. Thank you for the conversation.
No trouble at all. And you guys out there, look after yourself and live with passion. Bye.
I never give up. I never give up. I never give up. Turn around.